Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady. When not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, restaurateurs, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. This week, we'll shout out to spring, and then skip our usual trip to farmer's market because we get to have live here in the studio, not a chef, not a sommelier, not a restaurateur, nope, not even a plane or a bird. Here with me, the very reason why you are listening to me right now like this, Patrick Martins in the flesh, the granddaddy, making him sound old, of Heritage Radio Network and Heritage Foods. He also founded Slow Food USA, by the way, as we do with all of the illustrious food folks who we welcome on Word of Mouth. We'll get to know the person behind the personality and talk his newish book, The Carnivore's Manifesto. And because what could be more intimate than putting something in your mouth, whether it's pink like veal chop or sweet and wet like domestic vermouth, says Patrick in his book. Stay to the end because to wind it down. We will get to talk vermouth with Nate Adler, beverage director and partner of Huerta's The Bass Spot in the East Village. With that, I'm so pleased to welcome people we like. Patrick Martins.
Is this live?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, thanks, Leti. It's such an honor to be here. I'm really excited.
Such an honor to have you here because otherwise we wouldn't even be here.
The founder of the network. I'm sure it must be a big honor. This guy right in front of us spilled his drink. He was so nervous.
Did he really?
It's like, it's like having Beyonce and Jay-Z in here. Not that we're married.
No, not at all. And not that you don't have really nice calves.
Thank you very much for noticing. Yeah. You have very nice calves as well. We're both showing leg today.
I'm going to be sure to Instagram that. I think forget about our faces. Let's just put our calves together for our mug for the segment archive page.
Our two calves together are like cutting boards. You could cut meat on it, sushi, whatever. You know, they're like rock solid.
Thank you so much. So, Patrick.
About your calves?
We could talk about calves for forever. Okay, so, yum yum. Whose calves veal. Do you think would taste yummier?
Veal calves or my calves?
Yours or mine?
Yours.
Really?
Yes. Mine probably would taste like seagull.
Have you had seagull before?
No, but that's why all those people would starve on the coast. I mean, even though there was an abundance of seagulls, they just would still starve because you can't really eat seagull.
Do you know? Have we tried?
Well, I mean, what was that lost colony? The lost colony on the North Carolina, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they live right by the water. They all disappeared. They couldn't feed themselves. I think a lot of the early settling colonies, people starved.
Because they didn't have pig.
They didn't have pig. Yeah, there was no domesticated livestock species in North America. The only domesticated species, I mean, the only species was the bison, I think, and that's wild. It's never been domesticated.
So can I share?
Like the zebra.
Can I share with you a story about the domesticated pig and how much I love to eat it because I am Taiwanese and we know where it's at?
Mm-hmm.
So for some reason, off of online dating websites, men who do not eat certain foods keep on asking me out. And I'm like, it doesn't work that way.
I mean, do they read your bio?
Or, yeah.
I mean,
God. My bio says I'm a food radio host. I mean, who do you think I am?
I know. I mean, so obviously those end on the first dates.
I mean, so sort of.
Although sometimes it's fun to go out with someone who's like totally the opposite.
So one
food
guy,
allergies, lactose intolerant,
miserable.
Yeah.
So this one guy was like, "I'm allergic to eggplant and tomato," and I was like, "Tomato runs through my veins," you know. And then this other guy's like, "You know, I don't eat pork for some vaguely Jewish reason." And I'm like, I'm not vaguely Taiwanese. Like,
you're like, well, let me be super concrete. This date is over. Let me not be vague at all. Well, you know, the pork, if you think about how successful pork is, and yet what percentage of the world doesn't eat it? I mean, Muslims and hardcore Jews, what is that, like 25%, 30% of the population?
That's
and
it.
Yet it's still, we're slaughtering 220 million of them a week, I think, or something like that in America.
So where are you coming from right now?
I am coming from our office, which is right around the corner. It's the Heritage Foods Test Kitchen, but really it's just a warehouse where we package meats for direct-to-consumer shipments.
Yep.
So we sell to about 130 restaurants around the country, about 80 in New York City every single week. But we also have this really awesome mail order list of, you know, people get a weekly email from us, and we feature, you know, breed variety packages, nose to tail packages. But really what we do is we give people a chance to, for instance, try six different breeds of chickens all in one package, or six different breeds of pork all in one package. So it's kind of fun.
That's really rad. I think blind tasting should not just be relegated to wine.
I mean, also, enough recipe books. Leti, please help me start this campaign. With your social media presence, we're bound to... I want to do a total moratorium on the publishing of recipe books. From now, I think it should go a 10-15-year ban. And the only thing for meat people that we should still produce is a guide to the gastronomic differences of all the different kinds of breeds. I mean, does Taiwan have its own kind of breed of pig or cow that's like particular to that area?
I would have to look into that, but it would certainly be
the
most delicious pig or cow. And I don't know if there's not actually a book out there like that talks about each breed and their characteristics.
There's the Encyclopedia of Rare and Endangered Breeds by Donner, D-O-H-N-E-R, and that kind of, she gets into it. Because, you know, the English, of course, are like, oh, well, let me tell you something about the, you know, Highland cattle. But, you know, here in America, it's not as, gastronomy is not at the forefront like it is in Europe. So we talk more about like the size of the litters and how big their tummy is and how much it weighs. But, you know, it kind of is there a little bit. But yeah, we really do need a book in this country that breaks into it. Like, you know, the Navajo Churro is like one of the lambiest lambs ever. The Katahdin is a lamb that's a hair sheep. And so it is the lightest lamb in the world, you know? And so those are big differences. And everyone knows that, you know, Kobe tastes different than, you know, Kinina. And Angus, you know, tastes different than Ancient White Park, which is England's signature breed. So,
and I have a soft spot in my heart for red wattle chop, because many years ago, before I was ever in food, before I thought I knew I could make a living in food, I met Frank Bruni at a chat, actually, at the Jewish Community Cultural Center up in the Upper West Side. And then he said, he said, my favorite dish in town is the red wattle chop at Vinegar Hill House.
And I love that, because that has to be us. No one else is like, no, we sell the red wattle chop. Like, that's a breed that we're like the only basically meat group in the country.
It's so rad to have you on, because you're just such a zany and unusual bear. And I feel like I see you all the time at the office. But I don't think we've ever had a chance to have coffee.
Well, we do it on air. I mean, most of the time we interact is on air, because we were born for the radio. But, you know, someone was just asking me, they were saying, you know, what is your kind of mantra? What's the mission? And, you know, obviously everyone knows they should be eating less meat. We should be eating less meat in this country. And some people know, but everyone should know, that meat does need to be a little bit more expensive. It just has to. And so basically, I think the best way to go about eating less meat as a country and being prepared to spend more with it is to go head first, like from the high board dive into the gastronomic pleasures of the heritage breed movement, the rare breeds, gastronomy at its best. I mean, a lamb chop should be a memory you take with you for the rest of your life. And yeah. It should be like that every time. And we shouldn't be eating factory farm meat. Obviously, that's a hardcore ideal. Not everyone, you know, I had a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich.
Not as hardcore as vegetarianism.
Well, I mean, I actually think that this book I wrote with Mike Edison, who also has a show on this station called Arts and Seizures. It's on Sundays. I actually think the Carnivore's Manifesto, this book we wrote together, is actually a big vegetarian manifesto. Because basically saying, if that animal suffered and was fed low doses of antibiotics its whole life and had a potpourri of scurrilous genetics and was kind of like a... you know, an assembly of parts, you know, of, you know, like having big breasts or, you know, not able to walk, then no one should be eating that stuff. We should not be telling anyone to eat that dollar value meal.
And I think your book does a fantastic job of driving home the point via many, many, many tasty little bits of points. Each chapter is like, sometimes they're like only a page long. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Patrick. So about various topics like the sex drives of the animals we eat, to goat poop, to mm-hmm. Ted Turner, to truck drivers.
This is a test to
hipsters.
See. This is a test to see how much you remember the book.
Okay.
Which livestock boasts the best poop?
Goats.
Yes. Good.
Because they're perfectly round.
Yeah. Unmuddy turds.
Better than your baby.
Perfect. Oh, my God. I wish you could pelletize what comes out of that. Butters.
And I goats are really, really hilariously horny. I remember being on a farm and just sort of like watching the male goat. What's that called again? A male goat?
A borg? The male goat is a...
A goat?
A boar, no?
A boar? I have no idea. But anyway, the boy...
Goat.
The man goat's going... Aah!
Oh, Oh, well, anyway,
they're
sorry.
Like, they're it's like the bar. Mm-hmm. It's like when the goats are hanging out, it's like as if you've gone to like the neighborhood dive.
Well, we can't go to a goat farm with our calf muscles. I mean, the goats would go... They would get so horny, it's ridiculous. I mean... We have to be very careful. I always have to ask if there's any goats in someone's yard before I come in if I'm wearing shorts because, yeah, it's a mess.
So how was the process writing the book with our friend Mike Edison like?
Well, he was a great guy to work with. He basically came to my house every single Thursday, and there were periods where he came every single Thursday and every Friday for 8 months.
And that was like, you guys got to know each other really well.
Yes. I mean, he grew to deeply hate me,
mm-hmm.
but also respect me for certain things. No, yes, we got to know each other very, very well. And I feel, you know, like we would like to do another book together, which is a good sign. But
it's like the second date.
Yeah. Hopefully one that pays a little bit better and is read by a few more people. No, just kidding. But no, it was very interesting. When you go into that process with somebody, collaboration is just fantastic. And you grow to love them and you grow to respect them. And one thing I really learned about Mike and about his craft, his art, is how awesome it is to work with someone like him who has such a wide vocabulary, who is able to be different people in his writing. So in this book, he was able to help me be me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're kind of face changers. They have a huge vocabulary. They know how to build sentences. And he taught me about a punctuation mark, which is the long hyphen.
You didn't know about the...
M-dash, exactly. Well, what I love, it allows you to tag on independent clauses to any sentence.
To infinitum.
Yes, that's it's like the ultimate tangent key. And, you know, as a stoner, I'm all into tangents.
And without having to use messy parentheses.
Ah, the parenthesis. It breaks it up. That's a no. Kind of punctuation mark. The M dash is a yes.
Okay.
Do you know how to do an M dash on your Mac?
It kind of does it on its own. It turns into it. Like if it's in between two letters, it just sort of...
What do you have, like the Mac 10,000?
Yep. I'm like that.
I don't even have spell check on mine. Well, good job. I have to do option control dash.
I have a lot to get done, you know? And I just want to say, you talk about Heritage Radio and you call us Chefs, authors, visionaries, lunatics, journalists, historians, and hedonists.
You were under the lunatic one. Is that where you're about to ask?
I was just wondering. I mean...
No, lunatic for you, of course.
How about, can I be a lunatic and a hedonist?
Yes, you can be both.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
You don't have to ever be limited to one.
So heritage food actually happened on accident.
Yes, some cheese fell into a hole and into a cave and it turned blue. And I knew that we needed to get into livestock. What do you mean heritage started by accident? No, I think it was on purpose.
No, but it was on accident because like somebody covered, somebody said something about slow food selling, turkeys.
Oh, yes.
And then you had to do what the journalist said.
Yes, exactly. Merriam Burroughs wrote a cover piece for the New York Times the Wednesday before Thanksgiving and said that no one in America is going to have a heritage turkey, but that next year any American would have the possibility to taste a heritage turkey as long as it wasn't over 800 people, as long as they bought from Slow Food. So yes, she did kind of lay the gauntlet down that Slow Food would sell heritage turkeys. And it's funny, I just got a letter from her because I sent her a copy of the Carnivore's Manifesto, and she wrote me a beautiful line that said, this was just a few weeks ago, it said, it's amazing how far it's come. I live in Maryland, and now I can just drive down the road in October, November, and get a heritage turkey. I used to, and that would have been unheard of 10, 15 years ago. This project's come a long way, and it was great to see her say that. Because it's true. I mean, heritage is now kind of a known word amongst the food community.
So really, truly, it was that she just published an error and then the error turned into...
I think I might have told her that we would be willing to do it, but it wasn't Slow Food sanctioned.
Yes.
Yeah, Slow Food wasn't like, we want to get into the meat sales business. That's not what Slow Food does. Also, Slow Food doesn't like endorsing single producers.
Yes.
They like endorsing like the bourbon red turkey, but not necessarily raised by Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
But, in America, we were fighting a much larger, more complicated battle than they were in Italy. I mean, in Italy, there's still great respect for food traditions. People know what cheeses came from their towns, and they know recipes. They all cook. They go home for lunch, and they cook and dinner. It's not a great restaurant culture in Italy. They eat better at home than they do at the restaurant. So here we're a very different thing. We needed action.
Yes.
And plus academics, I love going to graduate school, but their style doesn't work. I mean, it makes me sick to my stomach how much talking there is about this country needing more slaughterhouses or animals need to be treated better. But very few people actually get in and do it.
Yeah.
And anyone who does is awesome. Like just today in the New York Times food section, they mentioned the Meat Hook sandwich shop.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Those types of communities, that's the future.
So then the leadership of Slow Food was like, what the heck, Patrick? Like, we're not doing it. And then Patrick was like, I'll just do it on my own.
Well, I said, it's too late. The order forms are already out to all the members. And since I have you, I've also signed on for a 3-part book series, Restaurant Guide. And they're like, what? But yes, the order form had already gone out and it had a list of all 50 states and what the shipping would be for each state. Because, it was all really done just like on the back of a napkin. And of course, that first year, I didn't know how big the turkeys would be. And I didn't know how big a box we needed. So I bought like massive boxes. Like I could have fit in one of these boxes. Also, since he had never raised that many turkeys before, the turkeys came out like a little bit larger than pigeons. So we were putting these little pigeons into this huge box. And we packed them in the back of a slaughterhouse. We had like 2 trucks of boxes and like 1 truck of turkeys. But we got it all done. And then it got better from there.
Where are you from?
I'm born and raised in New York. Mount Sinai Hospital, Klingenstein Pavilion, 102nd Street and 5th Avenue.
Mm-hmm. What did your mom and dad do?
My father, I'll get him over with first. He's a concert pianist in Brazil. He lives in São Paulo.
What?
He also hurt his hand, so now he's a conductor and he has this orchestra that tours around South America and around the world. But when he was in, he plays at Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center. But when he was a pianist, he was very well known and he was like Brazil's darling. His name was Juan Carlos Martins.
Whoa.
And then my mom was, you know.
Martins. That's how you say your last name.
Martins.
Yeah, instead of Martins.
Yeah, you can say Martins. Okay. I usually say Martins.
Okay.
And then my mother sold art, and she was a connector of people. You know, she spoke six languages. She lived all over the world. So she was just like an interesting kind of like diva lady who still lives in New York City. And she lived in Paris for 10 years. And she, yeah, connects people and sells things. And, you know, she's just like in the know.
So you know what? You understand me.
Yes, I know. That's why I called you mommy a few times. I hope that wasn't uncomfortable.
Brazilian. All right. So when did you, were you born here? Your dad moved back at some point. What were you like as like an elementary school kid?
I was very, very smart. I was, no, just kidding. I don't know. As an elementary school kid, you know, I was a, it was just a little snot-nosed little white kid from the Upper East Side that went to an all-boys school where you have to wear a shirt and tie. So I learned how to run fast away from the public school kids that would try to beat the crap out of us. But also, yeah, just, you know, witty, funny, trying to be the funniest one in the class. There were no girls, so there was no chance of getting laid, you know, so you basically could just be your stupid self. It was a real wake-up call when I went to Vassar. I was like, oh my God, what is this? You have to be polite and correct. You can't yell at the teacher in the middle of class, make fun of her. So we lived with them. I actually had a very interesting class. All the classes at Browning were like 10. I went there from second grade to senior year. All the classes were about 10 to 15 people. But then we were the first class. I graduated in 1990 that had in seventh grade, it brought in kids from other neighborhoods who had gotten in, I don't know how, through some program or something. So we actually had a class that was like 35, almost double the size of any other class. And it came from all these different ethnic groups, different neighborhoods, different stories, different life experiences. So it really made our class a nightmare for the teachers, but also really fascinating for ourselves.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're actually having a reunion tomorrow. It's the Browning School. I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, single-sex schools, I mean, like, what's up with that? It makes no sense. It doesn't prepare you better for anything than co-ed schools.
So then, college, what'd you study?
I studied psychology, mm-hmm. and then I left. I worked as a researcher for television for a while after graduating from Vassar, and then I went to worked at a bakery. Mm-hmm. Then I went to graduate school for performance studies, which is where I took my first food class. It was Food as Performance, taught by Barbara Kirshenblatt-Gimblett, this really mm-hmm. smart lady. And then I met Carlo right after graduating from there. And it was interesting. I stayed an extra semester just to study with her one more class. And that was the Food as Performance class. I'm still paying down that loan, that class, like 30 years later. No, I actually paid it back, but that was really important because if I hadn't stayed that extra semester, everyone's like, why are you here? Didn't you graduate? Are you like a fifth year senior? I'm like, well, this is graduate school, first of all. But yeah, I'm just staying. They're like, are you staying for a doctorate? I'm like, no. They're like, you know, you didn't get accepted to the doctorate program. I'm like, I know. I am just here for one class. And it was really interesting. I read for that class because I only did the one class just to take it. And I didn't do anything else. I lied around the house. I got really fat. And I read. And I read in that semester, I think I read like a book every 2 days for 3 months. And it totally expanded my brain. Even to this day, all the weed, all these years of weed has still not managed to get my brain back down to its original size because of that 3-4 month period of just reading so much. It's like a muscle. It's amazing. I recommend it to everybody.
I love reading. So, well,
but no, but like a lot.
Yeah, but what? Why?
Take a week off and read like 10 books. You'll be smarter for it.
Why? I'm going to try doing that.
No, it's really interesting.
I'm going to do it on a book. I mean, on a beach.
People will say stuff. You'll follow things better. Your mind is just more nimble. And obviously, this was many years ago, but I do recommend school. I mean, it's awesome. And the collaborations you make.
I recommend books. I remember when I first read my first ever chapter book, a book without pictures, only words. My mind was blown. I was like, how could this book without pictures be so interesting?
Well, no, I do like books with pictures in it. I look, I count how many pages to the picture, so I know I can jump past that page. You know, I'm like, that'll be a quick page.
So what was it? Okay, performance studies.
Yes.
So what do you mean by that?
It looks at everyday life as a form of theater. And it basically says, like, we have these behavior strips in our heads that are like the old film film, like in movies, you know, the reel, the negatives, yep. you know, and they would cut it mm-hmm. and it was like long in a movie reel. Like we have those behavior strips that have already been acted and we reenact them. So like me describing to you a performance studies, I'm not improvising anything. I'm basically just reenacting a performance with hand gestures for all of you people at home. There are a lot of hand gestures in this that are all part of a performance that, you know, and there's a short version, a long version, there could be 10 versions, but there's probably not 1,000. Yes. It was probably just 10. And so it looks at everyday life as forms of theater like that. Stages, actors, sets.
What was about this one teacher that moved you to stay an extra term?
She was so smart. I love, you know, she would say, you would be like, oh, blah, blah, blah. I went to this restaurant and, you know, it was this and that. And she'd be like, oh, yeah, time is an interesting way to look at restaurants. You're like, time? That is interesting. What do you mean? And she's like, oh, well, you know, and then she'll be able to talk just about the component of time to a meal. So she's really good at at looking at things through different lenses. And after studying with her, I was really wanting to do like a History Channel show that like re-examined history through the lens of the artichoke or through the lens of salt or, you know, through the lens of paprika or saffron, you know, and you would just be able to jump around history just by looking at saffron. It's really cool.
I think the world wants that show right now.
Well, I got rejected from the History Channel, or should I call it the Hitler Channel? It's always war on that channel.
Okay.
Like there's other things other than war.
Like yumminess. So yeah. You met Carlo Petrini in a restaurant.
At Remy Restaurant, which is now closed.
Mm-hmm.
Although Francesco is still the owner and chef at Antonucci's, which is right like a couple blocks from where Madonna, sometimes Madonna goes there.
Interesting.
Yeah. She lives right there.
So you saw Carlo, you shook his hand, you knew who he was? Like, what was that?
No.
What was it like?
I was like, why doesn't that guy shave? He has stains all over his jacket. There's a faint smell emanating from his suit.
Seriously?
Well, no, yeah. He would always take like 3-week-long trips. I'm like, pick him up at 6 a.m. under his house. I'm like, where's your luggage? He's like, this is it. I'm like, that's a briefcase. How are you going to, you don't plan to perspire at all. But no, yeah, he was just very, very charismatic. And he was like, I do all these things. There's a publishing house. All these young Italian kids work with me. And we do events and we travel around Europe to promote regional foods. And I was like, yeah, I'll come out for that for 3 months. And the 3 months turned into a year and a half. And certainly that year with Carlo is fascinating. I loved how international he was. I think sometimes people get too local. You know, they know somebody who does a really good thing, you know, locally. And that is also cool. But when you do get that magical moment to meet like an Alice Waters or, you know, someone who every city in the world has a garden in her name, or you really, it's fascinating because I love hearing stories about his time in the Congo or, you know, staying at the Dakota here in New York or the president of Brazil taking him to the underground banana bunker, or, you know, all these crazy stories, you know.
Wow.
And, it is cool.
So why did you two get along so swimmingly, instantaneously?
One is we did not speak a single word of the same language. No, just kidding. I spoke Italian good enough. I actually do speak Italian well. And he just liked me, I think. I was young. But, you know, he always had some guy he liked. There was always some person who wanted to pick him up at the airport. I don't know. I'm not saying he's gay. I'm just saying, like, he always liked having some guys around, like his boys, you know.
Yes.
They would drive around in the company Mercedeses, which were given to them mm-hmm. by Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
really?
Yeah. Well, they always had Fiat. Then they went to Fiat.
Okay.
Because, yeah, they were an established nonprofit, you know.
Okay.
So
by that time. Mm-hmm.
And they would go so many places, all those guys, that it was like good promotion. So, yeah, I think he just was committed to this idea of an international office and that he would only be so important if the organization never grew outside of Italy or Europe. And so he saw in me someone who maybe had the ingredients to spark people to open chapters and things like that. He probably got a lot more than that from me, and negative stuff too, you know, where he's like, God, this kid's a pain in the ass. He's always asking for more money. He's racked up a $25,000 phone bill. You know, he's sending all these FedEx packages. He's arguing with the people because he says he needs a better computer. And, you know, I was also a pain in the ass. And then when he did the Terra Madre, which is this massive and great event, I was like, that's going to cost the U.S. organization too much. We can't afford it. We need to be working on domestic efforts like the Turkey Project. And so, you know, those were points of contention between us and ultimately led to, you know, my leaving. But I love him to death, and I'm a member of Slow Food, and I spoke at their 25th anniversary here. I translated for Carlo, you know, so, and I'm very close with Alice Waters. So.
And Carlo and Alice came and spoke on our grounds, our campus, which was such an insanely magical yet low-key and cozy gathering.
Were you there? Did you see me translating?
Yeah, that was really impressive.
Thanks.
Yeah, wow. And Alice wrote the foreword to your book.
Yes. I'm really hoping people buy my book. Basically, only like 8 to 10 people have bought the book nationally.
Mm-hmm.
4 of those were I bought.
Mm-hmm.
2 my mom bought. So there are only 2 books at large, as we like to call them, actually purchased. Some have been stolen from the library, so there are other books in circulation, just not legally.
So
it's a fun book. Every 18-year-old, 16-year-old, 20-year-old should be given this book.
It is a fun book.
If they like me. This like lays the ground rules. 50 chapters, short essays. I think young kids especially would be like, that was a cool book. I agree. I use that sentence. But hopefully, I mean, ultimately the book was written for the disciples of
mm-hmm.
Peter Singer,
mm-hmm.
Animal Liberation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the greatest manifesto ever in defense of animals. Anti-factory farm, anti-experimentation for shampoos and things like that. He was the father of the vegetarian movement. Their children and those people themselves are like, but what about the farmer's market pork chop? And so this book is to convert them. It's also to convert that Burger King eating guy and mm-hmm. convincing him that $140 is actually the correct cost of a true heritage turkey.
Is the right word convert?
Well, vegetarians, no, we're not trying to convert vegetarians. We're just trying to say that it is okay. It has to be part of you. What you say is that it's okay under certain circumstances, which actually Peter Singer, I spoke at the Museum of Food and Drink mm-hmm. seminar, and he said 99% of everything I've been fighting for the factory farm thing, is accounted for by Heritage Foods USA and Patrick. It's just that extra 1% of eating it. So that was a huge thing coming from him. And he really said it. It's been documented.
So when you worked with Slow Food, what was the point that you met Alice?
Her assistant opened a chapter. So one day I came into work and the mm-hmm. FedEx guy gave me a package with 35 memberships, all in one package, paid, all with checks.
Wow.
So it was like Berkeley chapter
done.
At Chez Panisse, just signed, sealed, and delivered. And the members were, you know, Joyce Goldstein, Marion Cunningham, mm-hmm. James Beard's former assistant, Alice Waters, you know, her friend Davian Nelson, all those kind of old food broads, you know, and they helped start Slow Food. It was the legitimation that we needed. Because so once she started a chapter, it meant that anyone could.
You take your own...
I think it was 60 members, actually.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You take your own medicine. You eat your own pills that you prescribe for us. Sleep with your butcher and maybe your bartender.
By sleeping with your butcher, that would be masturbation. So yes, I qualify for that because I am a butcher of sorts.
Well, you married your cheesemonger.
Cheesemonger, yes.
How did you meet Anne Saxelby?
At the radio station.
Really?
Yes. I want to thank Roberta's and everybody here for allowing this place to exist because I might never have met Anne. I sought her out at events, but we would always just miss each other. And
so you already had like an industry crush on her?
No, I didn't ever seen her. This was pre-internet.
Okay, so but then why did you seek her out at events?
I had a sense. It was like karma that I just had a sense that she was young and single.
You mean you you knew her name, but you saw her with your eyes. But then
I just knew that, yeah, Saxe would be cheesemongers was like, it, there was just positive energy around her.
Wow.
I don't think I ever really, so I just came to see if she was there. And she looked at my face. She was like, get out of my face. You were disgusting to me. But she saw my calves. And then she was like, I think she saw your calves first. And she's like, marry me. But then she saw my calves. And then we did get married.
So what did you do? What, she was dining here. Like what?
No, she was on a radio show.
Okay. So then you like creeped into the station.
She said, I have great respect for all the things you've done. And I was like, I have all the great respect for all the things you've done. So then I think we went to Vinegar Hill House for our first date.
What? Cute.
Yes. So thanks to Jean and her crew there for providing us a nice garden table.
Hey, Jean.
We fell in love. We really knew we loved each other at Enoteca on 30th and 2nd. It's no longer there. 30th and 3rd, maybe. That's one of Jayton's and Denton's old places.
Mm-hmm. And you needed a little bit more wine in the picture for that mm-hmm, to happen.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Vinegar Hill House didn't pour enough.
Hey, so what did you do to propose to Anne?
I got a really beautiful ring because my mom married twice, and the second time she married the chief jewelry designer for Harry Winston.
Holy moly!
So even though he'd since passed away and we were no longer really connected, my mom and I had always maintained friendships with this one woman, Sarah Lee. Sarah Lee, if you're listening out there. I look at that ring every time and I smile. It's like totally made all our lives better. It's such a beautiful ring.
Oh my God.
And she, you know, totally hooked us up. So I just knelt down and asked her, you know, on our way to the airport, basically, to go down to Florida. And she said, I took my calf muscles out. I was wearing shorts even though it was freezing. And I showed her the ring. And then she said yes.
Amazing. Patrick, did you like ever think that you were going to be in food? I mean, what was that point where you thought, food, meat, yum?
Well, calf is a small cow. Veal is mm-hmm. made from calves. Mm-hmm. But I did not know. I mean, it was when I was with Slow Food. And then I saw Carlo and I knew that this idea could take off. It was a winning, smart idea. But it was basically before the internet. So people didn't know, you know. Now people be like, oh, there's 10 people in Nicaragua doing this. You would know about it already.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, like most, nobody knew about Slow Food. Really, almost nobody.
Dream job if you weren't in food. You knew that was coming.
No, I didn't. Movies, you know, television. I would still like to write a screenplay. I'm setting a 10-year plan, and I'm writing a screenplay with my friend Charles Steinberg,
mm-hmm.
and our consultant is Brian Kenny of the Hearst Ranch, who is one of the founders of the station.
I'll play the lunatic.
Okay, well, you're doing a good job.
Fantastic. So we are doing a Kickstarter for Heritage Radio Network right now, and mm-hmm. it's to revamp the website, much needed, so mm-hmm. you can find us better. I'm amazed at how many food lovers out there do not know that our 39 live weekly shows exist for your pleasure.
Mm-hmm. And all this news that they produce in the back of the house.
Absolutely.
And cutting-edge food news.
Cutting-edge food news. Really independent and original stuff. And then, of course, go on to Amazon.com or your friendly neighborhood bookstore and pick up The Carnivore's Manifesto. And if you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Leitihsu, L-E-I-T-I-H-S-U, at Heritage_Radio, hashtag WOM show, W-O-M show. That's short for word of mouth. And thank you so much, Patrick.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what an honor. Stay close, because after this quick commercial break, we'll wind it down.
Wind down.
And talk vermouth. With Nate Adler of Huertas.
program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Hsu on Heritage Radio Network. And I'm your host, Leyte. We have on the line Nate Adler, beverage director and partner at Huertas, the Basque place in the East Village. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So let's talk vermouth. What's happening over at Huertas right now?
So at Huertas, we actually make our own vermouth. And this was something that was inspired by a trip I took to Spain right before we opened the restaurant last year, where I went to all of these tapas bars, specifically in Madrid, and they were pouring this beautiful, sort of bittersweet, oxidized style of vermouth right out of their draft lines. So they called it vermouth de grifo, or vermouth on tap. And it would come on the rocks with a twist. And you would sit there, ideally during the daytime, with the sun shining, get a tortilla española, a couple olives, some boquerones, things of that nature, and a glass of vermouth with an orange twist on the rocks. And it was just this social experience that I wanted to bring back to New York upon opening Huertas in the East Village.
For those of us who are newer to this delicious juice, What is vermouth exactly?
So vermouth is actually quite simple in terms of its definition. It's an aromatized, fortified wine. So I'll break that down. Fortified, meaning that it's a wine that they add brandy to or some sort of spirit to up the alcohol content. And then aromatized is that they allow that fortified wine to sit or macerate with botanicals and fruits and herbs and spices, or aromatics as they call them. And it sort of takes on whatever flavors you put in there. And so it's a very versatile drink. It's very fun to play around with. And I think the best part about it is that really anybody could make it if they wanted to. And there is no definition official governing body that is saying this is vermouth and this is not vermouth. And so it makes it really fun and allows us to play around. So we actually make two different styles of vermouth at Huertas. We make a red or tinto and a white, a blanco. And our white is always a seasonal. So we use things from the green market. Right now, coming out of the winter, we've got apples and pears. And then a lot of baking spice in that one, but it's a dry style, and we use a little bit of honey for sweetening. And then we do a red, which has been our house vermouth since day one when we opened, and probably our most popular drink in the restaurant, believe it or not, because Americans really don't know much about vermouth, and we're trying to change that. And that recipe calls for a base of sherry and then a little bit of red wine, and we add a lot of citrus and bittering roots and baking spices. And what happens is that, and the way I describe it, is that it's sort of like a low-alcohol cocktail of sorts. It's got those bittersweet elements to it. A lot of people liken it sort of to a Negronian style or the way that it drinks, but it's not going to get you as drunk as a Negroni would.
And if I were to concoct up some of my own Leyte branded vermouth, what do I do?
What do you do? All right. Well, there are a couple of different things you can do, and this is something that we played with at the beginning. It's easiest if you start with an already fortified wine. So we start with sherry, which is a Spanish style fortified wine made in the south of Spain. But there are many other types of fortified wines out there. And so you can take any one of those, and what you do from there, like a port is another type, and then you just add a lot of fruits and spices at your own leisure, depending on how you want it to come out. And the beauty of it is that you can experiment. Like when we created our recipe, we actually took 5 or 10 different quart containers, and we had different proportions of different spices and fruits, and that allowed us to hone in on the recipe that we wanted to popularize and sell in the restaurant.
That sounds so yummy. I'm going to come in and see you and your vermouth very soon, Nate.
And they have a great meat buying program at Huertas.
They do.
Yeah, they buy from Heritage Foods, and you know, that means it's like the top of the line for the kitchen side too.
Yes, Patrick.
Yeah, we make a lot of sausages in house, and all of our sausages are made using Heritage breed, our Heritage Foods USA, which is really a special thing for us.
Yes, and Nate, as you've got to pick up Patrick's book, because he definitely makes mention of vermouth.
It's a synonym. Yeah,
There's nothing really better in the Spanish tradition than having a glass of vermouth on draft with a sausage that's made with the best pork product in the world, and also a tortilla española is something you always have to throw in there.
We're looking for the exact page number, but it's a pretty sexy
quote.
Well,
you read it. You read it earlier.
Yeah, but I didn't record the page number. Oh. I got it, and then I ran with it because it was like the most amazing segue.
Here it is.
It's on page...
page 113.
Okay.
It basically, vermouth and a woman's private parts are basically part of the same.
All right. Well, we're going to end on that.
Awesome.
Definitely, you know, we're going to get you a signed copy with that quote highlighted.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it.
Thank you so much, Nate.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Patrick. It's great to meet you over the phone.
Yeah, look forward to meeting in person.
And have a glass of vermouth and some sausages.
100%. Can't wait.
That was just our Wine It Down with Nate Adler of Huertas in the East Village.
Wine Down.
Our engineer Liz is totally playing with me today. And this is a very special episode of Word of Mouth with our very own Patrick Martins, the man who made Heritage Radio Network, Heritage Food, and Slow Food USA possible. Get his book. We're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth, heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.